You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It wasn't long after India gained independence from British rule that Mohandas Gandhi, the father of the nation, was assassinated. In India After Gandhi, The History of the World's Largest Democracy, historian Ramachandra Guha looks at the country 60 years since midnight August 14, 1947, and explains that the huge country's democratic institutions have survived despite its continued struggles to deal with geographic, social, and economic disparities, as well as violent religious and political disputes. The book is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Guha to the show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Didn't Winston Churchill predict that when the British left, India would fall back to, I'm quoting, the barbarism and privations of the Middle Ages?
He did. And then he also added later on that if we do grant India independence, German Janissaries will come in to secure the armed ascendancy of the Hindus, and we are still waiting for those German Janissaries.
And that's because of the Aryan connection? Why? How did he come up with that?
Well, he came up with that because, to sort of instill fear in the British public that our historic enemies, the Huns, will take over India if we leave.
But, you know, India was hardly united in 1947. How did the Constituent Assembly go about building a concept of nationhood?
No, I think, like this country, the United States, India was incredibly fortunate in having a group of visionaries who founded it. I think democracies need great men and women to found them. They can be run in mid-career by mediocrities and worse. And the distance between, Thomas Jefferson and George W. Bush is no greater and no less than the distance between Jawaharlal Nehru and, Sonia Gandhi. So we were very fortunate in having a group of visionaries who, following the spirit of Mahatma Gandhi, decided that they would build a nation on democratic lines which would not privilege a single religion or a single language, but would be truly multi-ethnic and multilingual.
To some degree, similar thing has happened in South Africa more recently.
Yeah.
Without Nelson Mandela, who knows what might have happened.
Indeed.
So is Nehru the
not
equivalent?
Not Nehru only, Leonard. I think there was a whole range of nation builders. There was a great lawyer from an untouchable background, B.R. Ambedkar, who had degrees from Columbia and the London School of Economics, and he was the chief draftsman of the Indian Constitution. Nehru's right-hand man was our Home Minister, Vallabhbhai Patel, who integrated the 500 princely states. You know, the British left us with a huge problem. They divided us into India and Pakistan, which was a call from India. Yeah, a call from India, and I'm going to put it off right away. They divided us into India and Pakistan, but left also 500 princely states, which were out declaring their own independence. And piece by piece, the fragments of this jigsaw puzzle fell into place.
So is there a strong sense of national identity today in India?
Yes, there is a sense that we are part of the whole nation. And
but there is constantly pulling apart, and there are even independence movements.
There are tensions.
There?
You know, I talked about the idea of India which Gandhi, Nehru, Patel upheld. That's a plural, inclusive idea of India. There are competing ideas of India. On the right, you have Hindu fundamentalists who want to make us a Hindu theocratic state. On the left, you have Maoist revolutionaries who are mobilizing the disaffected to create a totalitarian Maoist state. So it's a constant struggle. As in any democracy, where the middle ground has to hold between the extremists of left and right.
Have India's flourishing cultural sectors been a point of pride? For example, the international success of Bollywood films?
I think more than a sense of pride, I think Bollywood has played a great role in uniting India. You know, it's provided a common language, a discourse, a stock of jokes, of stories, and of songs. I mean, one of the great glories of Bollywood, probably not so appreciated outside India, is the wonderful lyrics and music of the song. So with it is, as you say, a great cultural ambassador for India outside, but also within India, it's united us.
Because the songs become hits from these movies. It is the Tin Pan Alley of India today.
Yes, and also it's
Not Ravi Shankar, but rather Bollywood film music.
Well, I think Ravi Shankar also plays a role. I think, as in any robust democracy, high culture and popular culture have to complement one another. But one of the great things about Bombay cinema is, again, its inclusive character. that Muslims, who are a minority, sometimes discriminated against in other sectors of Indian industry and enterprise. You know, our three greatest film stars today are Muslims. Many of our great singers have been Muslims.
Well, one of the ironies of India is that it is the second most populous Muslim country in the world after Indonesia. More Muslims than in Pakistan.
Indeed.
But you have a chapter here, chapter two, The Logic of Division, in which you pose the question, did India have to be partitioned? Do you think it would have been possible for India to have been able to hold its conflicts in check if partition had not been imposed?
Well, I think the British introduced aspects that divided Hindus and Muslims. They were aspects that predated the British. But I think by the 1940s, partition was inevitable because the Muslim middle class had been organized politically to demand a separate homeland. But while partition possibly was inevitable, it did not have to take place with such a colossal loss of life and did not have to leave such a bitter residue behind.
Well, millions died, in some cases killed, in other cases just simply because they had to move from place to place. But could partition have been handled differently instead of splitting the Punjab right down the middle and Bengal right down the middle? Because there were all sorts of other factors, weren't there? There's a Punjabi culture, there's a Bengali culture that supersedes whether you're a Hindu or a Muslim.
That's true, but what happens in history, Leonard, is that each of us has multiple identities. At a certain point in history, a certain identity becomes paramount. And in the 1940s, for the Punjabi Muslims, the Muslim identity was more important than the Punjabi identity. You know, 50 years later, they may regret it. But at that particular moment, in the new world that was being born out of the debris of the Second World War, the Punjabi Muslims and the Bengali Muslims de-emphasized their Bengali and Punjabi identities and overemphasized their Muslim identities.
But then the Muslim thing didn't hold because Pakistan split apart.
Yeah. Well, it did, because that happened because then language became more important than religion. Bengalis and Punjabis were both Muslims, but the Punjabis imposed Urdu, their language, on East Pakistan, which then became Bangladesh. And I think India learned a lesson from that. So when we became in our part of what was undivided British India, there was a clamor from the Hindi zealots of the north who spoke Hindi that their language should be imposed on the south and the west, and that was sensibly resisted. And we allowed the different provinces to follow their own language. So the Indian rupee note is a wonderful example of Indian pluralism because it has 17 languages and 17 scripts represented on it.
But then you have to have some kind of a national language.
No, that's an American vision. That's a European
vision.
Well,
in China, they imposed Mandarin.
But at a bloody cost. I think, in fact, I argue in my book that the greatest contribution of India to the theory and practice of democracy is to show that you can have multiple languages and yet a single nation. You know, if, for example, America now is coping with all the Hispanic immigrants, and should they all learn English? You know, France says, should all the Muslims who come in deny their Arabic or whatever? And I think we have shown that national unity is not necessarily premised on a single language.
My guest is Ramachandra Guha. His latest book, India After Gandhi, The History of the World's Largest Democracy, published by Echo. The real sore point to partition is Kashmir. That remains the biggest problem. You quote some prophetic statements made about Kashmir in the late 1940s and early 50s. Henry Grady, the U.S. ambassador to India at the time, said Kashmir is the one great problem that may cause the downfall of India and Pakistan. And Ralph Bunche of the U.N. said Kashmir is one situation you could never localize if it should flare up. It would influence the whole Muslim world. It is potentially the most dangerous in the world. Well, it hasn't turned out to be that, but it does remain a real problem and prevents India and Pakistan from reaching any kind of accommodation.
It does, and it has bedeviled India and Pakistan from the beginning. It's hurt us economically, politically, morally. And by us, I mean both countries. And yes, in some ways, it's hurt Pakistan more because Pakistan is a smaller country. And it has had to invest much greater emotional and military resources in on its case on Kashmir. But it's hurt India, too, because the Indian government has not always played fair by the people of Kashmir, as I document in my book. Elections have been manufactured. Pliant leaders have been put in place, instead of the more popular leaders who would have represented Kashmiri aspirations better. So Kashmir is really, in that sense, a stumbling block to healthy relations between India and Pakistan. And more importantly, the people of Kashmir themselves, I think, have not got a fair deal.
So you would suggest that a plebiscite be held?
I would not suggest that, because I think a plebiscite today is going to cause more damage.
But the people of Kashmir would probably decide to go to Pakistan.
No, they would not. That's not true. If there is a plebiscite today, I think more Kashmiris would choose independence over the other options. But I think a plebiscite will unravel all kinds of other things. You know, if it would lead to vengeful attacks on Hindus in Pakistan, vengeful attacks on Muslims. I don't think a plebiscite is today very dangerous. I think we have to move on. What we need is an Andorra kind of relationship, where the two countries exercise a soft, benign control over the Kashmiris, autonomy for the Kashmiris, free movement of Kashmiris between the Indian-held part and the Pakistani-held part, but not a plebiscite.
The Constitution of India has 395 articles and 8 schedules, making it one of the longest in the world. And it went into effect in January 1950. You write, the most controversial subject in the Constituent Assembly was language.
Yeah.
So they resolved that.
They did, because they decided not to impose Hindi on... Do you have Hindi and English as languages of interstate communication?
But hasn't that still remained an inflammatory issue?
No, it hasn't.
I read not all that long ago that there were BJP people who wanted again to impose Hindi.
Well, they've... Only at the extremes. I mean, if you look at around us in South Asia, Leonard, Bangladesh was split, Pakistan was split on the question of language. Sri Lanka is mired in an unending civil war on the question of language. And I think India has escaped those fates by allowing the people of the different provinces not only to speak their own language, but to go to school in that language, to express their literature and their film in that in their own languages.
One of the other problems of India is the matter of caste. And at the same time, it was the Constitution put in a one-person, one-vote democracy.
I mean, that was a bold act. I mean, the first general elections were called the greatest gamble in history. And it's a gamble that has been vindicated. In fact, the lowest castes vote in much higher numbers in our elections, which is counterintuitive. In the West, it's the poor have an apathy. It's the middle class who vote in greater numbers. So I think democracy has been an important... has played an important part in challenging and undermining the hierarchies of the caste system.
But the caste system is still rigidly in effect in many parts of India.
It's true, but, you know, if you have 5,000 years of history and hierarchy, you can't undo it overnight. It's democracy works slowly and incrementally. Look at the residues of race here. I mean, it's not as if white and black live in perfect harmony, but... Fortunately, from the 1960s, blacks have the right to vote. Blacks now have, African Americans are represented in public life, in the media. So it's a slow process. Democracy works slowly and incrementally. But I think authoritarian methods would have created even more problems.
Then how were the early elections conducted? You have all these different languages. You have a lot of people who are illiterate.
One of the heroes of my book is the first election commissioner, who was a remarkable man called Sukumar Sen. Fortunately, he was a mathematician. He had a gold medal from London University. And I think dealing with the mechanics of 180 million voters, of whom 110 million were illiterate, spread out over 28 states and so many different languages, I think he designed, for example, one of his innovations was symbols to identify political parties. Each one had a symbol, so an elephant, a hand, a tiger, a bullock cart, so that an illiterate person would vote for the symbol. But he had to design ballot papers, ballot boxes, the sequencing of elections, and he did a fantastic job because I think he laid the foundations of our electoral system.
Well, nowadays, what are the literacy rates or illiteracy rates? Are most people literate these days?
Yeah, I mean, they've gone down substantially.
Because I know that you no longer have those ballots. Now everything is done electronically.
It's done electronically. So we have now about 80% of men who are illiterate and about 60% of women. And we move now, as you say, to an electronic system.
What percentage of the population votes in national elections?
Between 60 and 65.
So better than the United States, indeed, but not as good as other countries.
And we have never had an election settled on a Florida kind of dispute. So I must say our electoral system is in that sense, more foolproof.
My guest is Ramachandra Guha, who has taught at the universities of Oslo, Stanford, and Yale, and at the Indian Institute of Science. He has written a number of books. The most recent, India After Gandhi, a comprehensive look at India's history after independence, and it is published by Echo. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Ramachandra Guha, who has written a number of serious books and even a couple of less serious books. He's written a book about cricket, for example, which, of course, is, for Indians, a very serious matter. His latest is a history called India After Gandhi, The History of the World's Largest Democracy, published by Echo. It's been fashionable in open market India to dismiss Nehruvian socialism as an economic straitjacket that stymied economic progress in India. Do you agree?
No, I think that's an anachronistic judgment used with the privilege of hindsight. In the 1950s, there was a massive consensus among the intellectual elite across the Western world, and indeed in India, that we needed a mixed economy, that the state had to play a crucial role in furthering economic development. In the 1950s, the Soviets were regarded as an economic miracle. The Americans were scared because of Sputnik. They thought, you know, that there was something about socialist planning that made the Soviets more technologically sophisticated. So Nehru was a man of his times. You know, he promoted a policy that was in keeping with the times and which was totally endorsed by the other scholars and economists around him.
But from 1950 up until at least 1980, India struggled with a low rate of growth, just 3.5%, which was often referred to as the Hindu rate of growth.
Yeah.
And then after the late 1980s, the country has undergone a remarkable transformation, largely, I guess, brought about by Narasimha Rao's government, which opened up the economy. So perhaps Nehru was wrong.
No, he wasn't wrong.
Was it a stabilizing influence?
Nehru's generation, United India, gave it a democratic infrastructure. Secondly, even the capitalists and industrialists of the time wanted protection because they were infant industries. They wanted to keep out foreign competition. They needed the guiding hand of the state. And probably the best time to open out would have been the 1970s. I think we were 20 years too late when Nehru's daughter Indira Gandhi, who was as much an instinctive autocrat as her father was an instinctive democrat, but the time came to loosen the control of the state over the economy, she actually centralized further. So I think Nehru was not wrong. His policy was right for its times. I think the 1970s would have been the time to open up.
Now, what about her autocratic instincts? The country could have gone further and further into some kind of a one-woman or one-man rule approach, as Pakistan has. Why do you think India was able to right itself?
Well, it's a fascinating question, Leonard, and there's no clear answer. In my book, I argue that it's clear why Indira Gandhi imposed the emergency which led to the abrogation of democratic rights in 1975, because there was an adverse court judgment against her and she wanted to protect her seat. So we know why she imposed the emergency. We don't know why she suddenly and impulsively called off the emergency in January 1977, 18 months later, and held elections. Now, I argue in my book that it was because of consistent pressure by Western liberals, particularly British liberals, who chastised her for betraying the ideals of her father's generation. And it's striking that, you know, the worst influence on Indira Gandhi was her second son, Sanjay, who, not to put too fine a point on it, was a ruffian and a goon and a bully and a brute. And this is one act, the calling of elections, in which she did not consult her son because she remembered her father's memory.
But why go after the Sikhs, who had been such a loyal part of the government throughout its history?
Well, that was a tragedy for which she paid for her life in the early 1980s. You know, she played cynical politics in the Sikhs. She promoted one wing against another, and which led to the consolidation of the radical or fundamentalist wing. And then there was an uprising against the Indian state, which she put down with an excessive use of force, you know, the storming of the Golden Temple, and then she paid with her life.
But it went against all these traditions of secularism that her father had worked so hard to institute, because she was now talking about a kind of a Hindu basis for Sikhism, which insulted the Sikhs.
It did. But tragic as it is, has a happier ending in that 25 years later, the Sikhs are totally united again, emotionally and culturally, with the Indian nation. Our prime minister is a Sikh. The head of our planning commission is a Sikh. The chief of army staff is a Sikh. So it's taken 20 years. It's cost a lot of lives, a lot of bad blood. But today, it's had a happy ending.
The country still has a lot of inequities. You point out that this economic boom has not benefited everyone.
Without question. The real growth areas are the south and the west. And the east and the center are still deprived, disadvantaged. The tribal people who occupy the Central Indian Highlands are probably the worst hit by economic globalization because they live in parts of India which have very rich mineral resources. And in the exploitation of the resources, the tribal people have been pushed off the land and have become cannon fodder, in fact, for a growing Maoist insurgency. So they are worrying signs. I mean, the growing disparities between rich and poor are placing strains on Indian democracy which need to be seriously taken account of.
And the idea that there even are tribal groups in a country where the culture goes back 5,000 years. These are people who were indigenous before the Indo-Europeans came in?
There are long arguments about it, but basically the tribal groups are about 8% of India's population. They don't have a caste system. That's one important distinction. They treat their women much better than caste Hindus do. Muslims, the women are never in Partha. And they live very close to the forest and the land.
But they're seen as aboriginals?
We don't use the term aboriginals. The constitution recognizes them as a special category, along with the lowest caste, as benefiting from affirmative action. So 7% of all jobs in government, 7% of all seats in parliament are reserved for the tribal people.
But at the same time, as you say, they're being pushed off their land and actually are suffering from this new economic boom. Is there anything that can be done?
I think Indian democracy has treated them unfairly. I think they're the one group who've lost out. They don't have visible national leaders. They're not represented in the professions. You won't find tribals who are lawyers, doctors, judges. The Indian state has over 60 years. It's not a new thing. It's not just economic liberalization. I think the Indian policies have tended to ignore and undermine the interests of the tribals, and I think it's past time that they be corrected.
Despite affirmative action, because you write that the greatest failure of independent India is its inability, some would say unwillingness, to educate all or most of its citizens. So it has policies in place that it just ignores?
Well, I think the capacity of the state has been eroded over the last 30, 40 years. And there's a great deal of corruption at the heart of Indian public policy. And that has affected particularly the poor population. For example, you may have a policy which says the poorer sections must get free food. But the food is then siphoned off and sold on the black market by merchants and contractors. So I think there's a great deal of corruption and a lack of transparency in public policy in India.
My guest is historian Ramachandra Guha, G-U-H-A. His latest book, India After Gandhi, The History of the World's Largest Democracy, published by Echo. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You wrote in a newspaper article that in 1928, Gandhi warned about the unsustainability on a global scale of Western patterns of consumption. God forbid that India should ever take an industrialization after the manner of the West, he said. So do you think Gandhi would be unhappy about India's economic boom and its increased consumption?
He'd have mixed feelings, Leonard. I think he'd welcome the fact that we're still a democracy. He'd welcome a fact that rates of poverty and illiteracy have gone down. But he would be concerned about the fate of the tribal people, and he would be concerned about the rampant consumerism. I think the real question that faces the whole world today is, if India and China go down the Western path of consumption, what would be the consequences, not only for the rest of humanity, but for the fate of the earth we all cohabit?
What do you think he'd feel about the continuing tensions between various religious groups? The BJP grew in strength during the administration of Narasimha Rao, the man who opened up the economy, in response to what he was doing?
No. I mean, these are independent processes.
But they wound up being the major opposition at the time.
But I think, again, it's part of a global trend. I think there's been a rise and resurgence of religious fundamentalism all over the world. Islamic, Jewish, Christian, and likewise in India with Hindu fundamentalism. And Gandhi, who was a deeply believing Hindu, when he was murdered by a Hindu fanatic, and when he died with the name of Ram on his lips. So Gandhi, I think, practiced a pluralist, inclusive form of Hinduism, and he would have been appalled by the BJP and the kind of assertive, dogmatic, closed Hinduism that they represent.
And Nehru felt that it was the responsibility of the state to make the Muslims feel secure. Many modern Indian politicians think it's the responsibility of Muslims to remain doubts about their loyalty.
Yeah, I think that's tragic. I think Nehru always said, we will not make India into a Hindu Pakistan, even though our neighbor runs its polity on theocratic lines. Here, the majority will not impose its will on public policy. Every citizen will have equal rights, regardless of faith. And I think those who ask Muslims to prove their loyalty to the nation, rather than require that the state provide every citizen equal rights, are, you know, betraying the spirit of the Indian Constitution. Not just of Gandhi and Nehru, are violating the spirit of the Indian Constitution.
But you seem to suggest that despite all of the problems, and we've seen a fair number of them, including people, trains being bombed and some awful things, women being raped in revenge for religious slights, that India will somehow muddle through?
Yes, I think, you see, India is a work in progress. No democracy is perfect. I mean, there's a lot of crime in this city. I mean, there's rape and crime and murder and racial discrimination in the US. You know, you can look at the dark side, you can look at the positive side. In my book, I say that India is 50-50. You know, the fact that it's a modest success. But at its birth in 1947, no one expected it would survive 60 years as a united country. And no one ever thought that a poor, diverse, disparate, illiterate population could conduct democratic elections. So I think a citizen, if the glass is half full, Leonard, a citizen will say, it's half empty, which is right. And a citizen will be agitated to redress the wrongs that are there. But a historian has the liberty and the privilege to say it was not even supposed to be half full.
But India, despite the fact that it's a democracy, really has had a royal family.
No.
Well,
they lost elections. It's had the Congress Party, which was a decentralized democratic party, was converted into a family firm by Indira Gandhi. That has damaged Indian democracy. But the Congress Party has now in a minority. The Gandhi family cannot impose its will as it could in its imperial heyday in the 1970s and 80s. So it's wrong to see it as a...
Despite the fact that Sanjay Gandhi said, future generations will not remember us by how many elections we had, but by the progress we made.
Luckily, he was wrong, yeah.
He defined progress by demolishing slums and also sterilizing certain people. Why was there a sterilization program?
Because he identified the growth of a population as our most serious problem. In fact, today, 30 years after Sanjay Gandhi, we are celebrating the fact that we have such a robust young population. You know, we speak of India's democratic dividend. We say that the West is aging, China is aging, and this is the window of opportunity that India has to use its young and skilled population to economically develop. Sanjay Gandhi was, as I said earlier in the program, a narrow-minded, half-literate bigot.
What did you think of his brother, Rajiv, who came to power after Sanjay was assassinated?
Well, unlike his brother, Rajiv was not malign. He was not a man. He was a decent man, rather foolish and poorly advised. But he wasn't a brute.
He unintentionally sparked the worst Hindu-Muslim riots since partition.
He was very poorly advised. There was a dispute over a shrine in Ayodhya in northern India. And he opened the locks to that shrine and allowed the dispute to, flame up. So he was very badly advised. That's true, yeah.
India has changed in its relations with its neighbors for a while. America saw India, especially under Nehru, as being a little too friendly to China and the Soviet Union. Then there were border disputes, there were wars. Where is India right now in relation to the various powers of the world?
Well, in relation to China, it has much better relations. The last Chinese prime minister who came to India first came to Bangalore before he went to Delhi and said, what moves us now is business, not borders. So I think that's a healthy sign. Our relations with the U.S. are much better. I think the U.S. for much of our history has not appreciated the strengths of Indian democracy. I think the fact that the U.S. has consistently supported theocratic and authoritarian Pakistan over us has wounded Indians very much. So happily, that's changed. Where the real stumbling block lies is with regard to Pakistan. I think Indian relations with Pakistan, unfortunately, are still dominated by suspicion and animosity on both sides, and that's tragic.
What's India's position on Sri Lanka, where an autocratic Hindu insurgency has been fighting for independence?
Well, we certainly would like stable relations. I think the Sri Lankans could learn from our federal system, where center-state relations allow a great deal of autonomy to the provinces and the districts. I think there have been mistakes in Sri Lanka on both sides. There's been the brutality and the dictatorial tendencies of the Hindu insurgents you talk about. But the Sri Lankan government also has not always honored the principles of federalism. They tried to impose their language, Sinhala, unwillingly on the Tamil-speaking people. There have been lots of human rights violations by the Sri Lankan army. I think India would like Sri Lanka to be, like India, a plural, multilingual federal democracy.
Isn't there a possible conflict based on the that little bit of water that separates India and Sri Lanka now? Because of an important god, Ram.
Yes, I mean it's curious. There's a natural formation in this in the sea between India and Sri Lanka, and because of the natural formation, ships have to go right round Sri Lanka to connect the western and the eastern coast. And now there's a proposal to dredge a channel to make transport much easier. And the North Indian Hindu radicals claim that the natural formation was actually a bridge built by Lord Rama's Monkey Brigade. And this has caused a great deal of offense on this in the south, because they feel that with no disrespect to the Lord Ram, that this is a natural formation. And, you know, economic prosperity and will be greatly enhanced by the shipping channel. But it is part of the curious nature of Indian democracy that it creates all these kinds of conflicts.
Ramachandra's book, India After Gandhi, The History of the World's Largest Democracy, is published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. ¶¶